Hey everyone, I'm Simmer, a student at Harvard University.
And I'm Roger, a student at King's College London.
And this is That Medic Podcast.
In this episode, I have the pleasure of speaking to Johan Malawana, the founder and director of the Healthcare Leadership Academy and CEO of Medics Academy. In this podcast, we discussed his past role as chairman of the Junior Doctors Committee, the reasons for NHS staff burnout, and what it takes to become a scholar for the HLA. As always, I started the podcast by asking the question, why did you decide to study medicine?
Classic kind of Sri Lankan family way. I wanted to actually study history because I really like history and kind of I love the arts, like art subjects. But my father pointed out that that is not a relevant career path for a person. And when I say pointed out, I mean he quite strongly advised. And so he said that I come from a Catholic Sri Lankan family, so I definitely didn't want to be a priest. And so the next best thing is being a doctor. And so studying is studying, right? It's information is information. And so whether you study one subject or the other, I wasn't really that bothered what I studied because I was studying. And so, in the end, my dad was like, you need to do biology, chemistry, maths. That's how you get into medical school. And I was like, oh God. So I'd given him a form after GCSEs that said history, geography, and like business studies or economics, I think. And he was just like, what is this rubbish? History, cross. And he put biology, chemistry, maths, and signed it and gave it back to me. And I was like, okay. I wasn't like one of these classic, I really want to be a doctor. I've like met a doctor and he's inspired me sort of scenario. But then when I went to medical school, I mean, it took me a while to actually get really like into medicine, but it was probably in the middle, probably about the second or third year, I realized actually, what am I doing? This is an incredible subject, right? Because like, it was so interesting. And I'm like, I'm quite interested in people. I like other people, and I like listening to them. And I have to say, medicine is awesome for being like nosy. And so you hear the most random stories and the most odd things. And you know, the science is really cool as well. But you know the human aspect of medicine is fascinating. And so so I basically got really threw myself in by about the third year and really got into it. I have to say, when I say threw myself in, I was very good at doing everything that wasn't medical school. So I did what I needed to pass, but I was also very aware of all the other opportunities that you gained by being a medical student and being a doctor. And so I took full advantage of that and did loads of random stuff at medical school. So basically I fell in love with the area and the subject and generally the kind of concepts around health and the health kind of sector in general and all the things that you can do in it. It got progressively more true as I went through my career. I mean, I think there's an odd thing that's going on right now where people seem to be falling out of love with medicine as they go through their career, whereas actually I found the complete opposite. I was getting more and more in love with the subject and the area. The same is true of actually how I ended up picking my specialty. So I ended up as an obstetrician and gynecologist, and mainly an obstetrician. And I remember at medical school, I really didn't like obstetrics. I really thought if you're a male obstetrician in East London, a male obstetrics or a medical student doing obstetrics in East London, it is not like in the naughty, early noughties, it wasn't conducive with actually getting anything done. Like there was a lot of standing outside the door being screamed at sort of scenario. And so it wasn't my favorite subject at medical school. I was convinced that wasn't what I wanted to do. But then I ended up getting a job in obstetrics. And I remember telling my supervisor at the beginning that she was like, oh, so why do you want to do obstetrics? And I was like, I don't want to do obstetrics. I got this job and now I have to do it. And she was like, what the hell are you talking about? Like, why are you here? And I was like, well, you know, any job I do it to my full like, you know, passionately do it. I don't back off. And she was like, okay. And she looked really suspicious at me. And then I came back 3 months later for one of our supervision sessions. And she basically was like, how are you getting on? And she had this kind of general suspicious look at me. And I was like, oh my God, this job's amazing. It's really interesting, isn't it? Like, you get all these people having babies, and like, they're all, it's like the only time you go and see a doctor for a happy reason, and like, they leave after they've had the baby, and there's like loads of surgery and medicine and all this. And she looked at me and she was like, yes, I know that, I've done that for like 20 odd years, right? And I was like, oh, okay, yeah. And so my insights into obstetrics to an obstetrician was not exactly revelationary for her, but it ended up I ended up falling in love with the subject. Actually, it was really cool. Like, and I always said to students that I kind of looked after that, basically, you know, it's the only time you get to go and do medicine in a subject where it's a happy reason. Like, the only time someone goes to see a doctor for a positive, happy reason is when you go to the obstetrician. So that's how I ended up in medicine, and in medicine where I was, basically.
It's really great to see, you know, that you sort of found your calling within obstetrics and gynecology. But from my sort of understanding, you know, it's not always the case for a lot of doctors. And I think, you know, what you see, sort of see nowadays is that a lot of doctors are now sort of looking towards alternative careers, you know, even outside of medicine. So just wondering if I could get your sort of thoughts on why you think, you know, this is the sort of case at the moment.
It's an interesting question, and there are so many layers to it, right? There's the layers of like why an individual leaves medicine, like what's the issue with one person and their relationship with the work or their subject matter or the kind of working environment they're in. And then there's the generic kind of, are we actually, first of all, picking the right people to become doctors, or are we telling them, or are we kind of giving them insights into what it is to be a medic that's actually realistic? So we're picking like people that actually know what they're going into. I think the other thing is that because medicine has become so competitive, I mean, this is one of the big issues, right? The medicine is so competitive to get into that actually there's a degree of like competition going on. So because people are naturally competitive, there are some people that are just, you know, competitive, and they because it is a competitive subject to get into, they then pick medicine because it's seen as, oh well, I want to be the best in my year, and what do the best people in any given year do? Oh, they go to medical school or they go to Oxbridge or whatever, and so therefore I compete to get in, and etc. So there is a degree of like that going on, because you see it actually within medicine itself, right? People pick subjects to do. Often when a subject is competitive in medicine, it has this kind of snowball effect. So you get this kind of this psychology of people, like where something is competitive, suddenly there's like a massive oversupply of people wanting to do that subject. And then some other subject will be massively undersupplied. And then all of a sudden there'll be some sort of like shift, and people will decide that something else is really important. And so then there's a huge flow as people become more like compete to do this subject as opposed to that one. And I think that you see that throughout medicine, the medical careers anyway, right? So there were periods, I remember there were periods where in obs and gyne, for instance, where obs and gyne was so unpopular and people just wouldn't do it. And then there were periods where obs and gyne was super popular and there was massively oversupply in obs and gyne in terms of people wanting to do it. And the same we've seen in GP, and we see it in, like, you know, orthopedic surgery is the obvious one where everyone decides they want to be an orthopedic surgeon. Right now it seems to be ophthalmology, like, for whatever reason, everyone wants to be an ophthalmologist right now. And so, like, and when I was at medical school, like, ophthalmology, yes, it was competitive, but it wasn't like what it is now, where every third medical student I talk to says they want to be an ophthalmologist, right? And so you just have this kind of weird thing where you start selecting super competitive people, and the competition itself is often the psychology that sometimes you see that's at work. And so they then like pick specialties that are, maybe they don't fully understand why they're picking it, and they, like, they're used to competing, so they do what they need to get in, but in their heart of hearts, they're not really wanting to do that subject, if that makes any sense. And so I think that's one of the things. So often then when people end up in the place they end up in, they're unhappy because they haven't really picked it for the reason that is, like, the true reason for themselves. They've picked it because it's the thing to do. And so, I mean, I say this to our, like, you know, anyone I mentor, and I mentor quite a lot of rap people nowadays, but I often say to them, you know, really start thinking about who you want to be when you're like 10 years from retirement or 5 years from retirement. You know, in that period when you've got kids and you've got family and you've got all these other things that are much more important than your job. And they should be more important because, you know, your kids should be more important to you than your job. But, you know, you need to pick the thing that you want to do at that age and like work towards that goal. Whereas, you know, if you are someone that literally gets defines themselves by their job, they define who they are by their work, then and you think that's who you are, then fine, pick, you know, make all your decisions purely based on career. But I mean, I didn't find that was true for me. And I suspect from a lot of the discussions I've had with a lot of professionals over my career, and, you know, either in mentoring relationships or in just general, like getting to know them, I think that's true of a lot of people. I think they just sometimes make decisions based on essentially what they're living in the moment, as opposed to what they want to do in the future.
So I think you sort of touched on the sort of culture you see at medical school, you know, in terms of the level of competition. You know, is there anything we can be doing to sort of change this mentality?
If you pick people based on competitive entry, then you end up with competition. So that's the nature of the beast, right? And so, you know, I remember there was a debate, what, more than 15 years ago, around how you pick people for foundation. I think it was about 13 years ago. And I remember presenting an argument at the time, which was, okay, if we all actually want it to be, because everyone argues about it being fair, right? Fairness is the thing. And I remember making an argument at the time, which was, well, actually, if you want it to be fair, the fairest way is to essentially just run a lottery, right? So who gets to work in London and who doesn't get to work in London? You could just run a lottery. I mean, this was at the time, you know, from about 2003 to about 2011, the times I was involved anyway. I remember there was a lot of debates around how you do competition to get into London or not get into London. London was the big question back then. And then, and is it fair that certain people can, you know, you get a preference because you went to a London uni as opposed to a not a London uni, et cetera, et cetera. And I remember this whole debate about fairness, and I remember saying at the time, you know, the fairest way would then just be to run a lottery, right? Everyone just puts their name in a hat, you pull it out, and, you know, you go where you go, and everyone is equally unhappy or happy, right? So there's an equal level of misery or not misery. But obviously that is not, you know, no one's going to agree to that, right? Because, you know, and so it was the very basis of the reason why I one of the things I did early on in my career was I wrote the policies around the interdisciplinary transfer system. So the system where you allow doctors to move around the country based on personal circumstances. So before I was in the role of being the education lead at the Junior Doctors Committee, this was back in 2007, there was just no system for that. People were just put into whatever job they were in by competition. And then there was no way for things to change. And you know, if you're in a role for like, what, in some cases, 8, 9, 10, 11 years, like not having the ability to change due to circumstances was just like killing some people, you know, no, not like actually killing, but, you know, they were emotionally massively scarred by that, by the reality of that, which is being separated from loved ones, being separated from partners. You know, that was a big deal, right? Being separated from your partner was such a common thing in the 90s and early noughties, and yet people just had to suck it up and deal with it. And I just remember thinking, this is just so wrong. And so I basically campaigned and fought to get the system in, and we got, and actually it was by that stage like pushing at an open door, because I think everyone realized this was an issue. And I wrote a kind of policy document I was working very closely with a lady called Rachel Podlack at the time, who's now the head of the BMA in Wales. And basically her and I were working closely in the education and training remit at the Junior Doctors Committee. And so we came up with this whole policy area and wrote up the policies kind of ideas, and then negotiated it, got it through the system, and actually managed to land the whole change across the UK within, like, I think it was within 12 months, and actually had massive a massive impact, because people could suddenly, there was this safety valve. I mean, it wasn't perfect by any stretch of the imagination. It has been iterated on, you know, virtually annually, I think, ever since. But actually just creating the safety valve to allow people to have that was really important.
Now, Johan, you know, a lot of your time these days is spent as director of the Healthcare Leadership Academy. Just wondering if you could sort of explain to those listening its sort of origin story and a bit about the sort of work it's doing in developing early stage healthcare professionals.
Sure. I mean, back in 2016, when I finished the role as a junior doctors committee chair, I basically looked at my career and I just thought, I mean, don't get me wrong, I loved obstetrics. I thought obstetrics was the coolest subject ever. But I also was very aware that I had probably about, 30 years of my career left, right? And I wanted to tackle a problem that I'd been basically grappling with myself in my own kind of, my own intellect, as it were, for a long time, which was around how do we actually improve the kind of education and lives of young professionals. That's what I've basically spent most of my career since about, like, you know, since I was a medical student working on, like, improving the kind of education system and the lives of clinicians. And so, and I kind of got to a point in that point in 2016 where I genuinely wanted to understand what I should do next. And again, it comes back to a conversation with my wife, who I, despite, she doesn't think I listen to her very much, but I listen to her incredibly. So she basically said to me, you know, she said, you know, you should just do what you think you should do. I don't think you should like not. I think if you like, she was really sweet, actually. She said to me, I've watched you over the best part. I think by that stage, we'd been together for quite a long time. And she'd also been at medical school with me. So we hadn't been together during then. But she knew me from medical school. And she said to me, I've known you for a very long time. And the one thing I can say about you is that when you put your mind to something to do something, then it usually gets done. So why limit yourself by doing things just because the world tells you to do it that way? Do it the way you want to do it and don't worry about it. I'll support you. And I was just like, okay, that's like a pass. I've got a pass. So in the end, I started. I started Medics Academy first, which is the technology company I run, and then and we were building. What we were trying to do is build scaled education. Right? How do we actually build education systems using technology and make those education programs much more enjoyable to the individual? Like, so it's actually like the individual clinician going through, like really focusing down on the user experience journey of the. So I'd heard so much about this user experience and design thinking, but actually in practice it just never happened right in healthcare. Like, people don't focus on the individual, the course of going through like the thing. They talk about it but don't do anything about it. And so I kind of was like, okay, well, how do we actually focus on making the best experience for people that are going through? And early on in that, I also knew that my passions were, I'd spent quite a long time mentoring young professionals and early stage professionals and during my previous career. And so I was very aware of my passions in terms of just trying to support people early on. And I said to someone recently, actually, the main thing I wanted to do was give people the opportunities I had, right? So I was very, very lucky, right? I was incredibly lucky in that I came from a state grammar school, right? So I got into the local grammar. I went to my local medical school. I was really fortunate that despite being the worst student possibly in that medical, I was always like supported by both my tutors. Like, I got on really well with my tutors. I enjoyed my subjects, etc. I was just always distracted with everything else I was doing, right? But I was really well supported, and I didn't come top academically. In fact, my wife did come in the top six in our year. But the rest of the, like, basically, I wasn't like that. And so, I still got opportunities that just were unbelievable. Like, they were genuinely, like, made my career. And so I got to do leadership roles. I got to work hard on projects that I really cared about. I could deliver things I was passionate about. And those were, I mean, whilst it was really hard work, I wasn't given anything on a plate. When I saw an opportunity, I took it. I was really well supported in that. And I wanted to create that for other people because I saw so many people unhappy. So the HLA was like a total side project, right? It was this thing that I was going to do on the side, which was about helping a group of young people to find who they were. And we used a lot of the resources from Medics Academy, so the company I was running, to grow that out. And what happened was we used it actually not to grow it out, but initially we used it just to make it a reality, right? To actually just make it work. And so we did it. We ran it for 9 months as a pilot. And the results were like phenomenal. Like people were like talking about how great the experience was. And we were really focused on this user experience. And then we ran a second pilot, like a full rollout the second year. And then by the third year, we had like really good support. And we were basically able to scale it out to multiple cities and across different like people like the, we were really fortunate in the Norwegian Medical Association took an interest in what we were doing because of, you know, I obviously had links over there because of sort of working with the former head of their junior doctors committee. And they started sending their doctors, so the medical association itself started sending their doctors over to London to be on the program. And so we suddenly got this taste of this kind of internationalization of it. And then suddenly these other students from Holland started flying over as well, right? So then it just grew and grew and grew. And so by then, right now, it's just, you know, it's got quite significantly larger. We have about, I think we've had about 300 people or more now going through the programs, and we've got about a delivery group. So the people, like both staff and volunteers, of about 40 or 50 people now. So like faculty and all that stuff. The program was the first one accredited by, we're at an institution level by the Institute of Leadership and Management. So they'd approached us and wanted to accredit it. And so they gave us the ability to make people fellows and members of the Institute ourselves. So we don't have to go through their accreditation process because they said that the quality of what we were doing was so good. And then we also created a relationship with UCL Medical School. And we also got a relationship, we have a relationship now with UCLan Medical School. And so between all of that, we were really fortunate to kind of grow the entity. And I have to say the reason it grew as well as it did was because of the team at Medics Academy, because we had an incredible group of people that joined that were involved with starting the program. I mean, the person who I credit as basically being as important as me for everything to do with the HLA is a former pediatrics trainee, now a genetics trainee, a clinical genetics trainee called Melody Redmond, who I worked with at the BMA, and who genuinely would, like, the HLA just would not function if it wasn't for Mello. So she started with me right at the beginning, and she took over one aspect of the work, and then she slowly took on more and more of the work as we were. And like, she's just like, she's not like me at all. She's like the complete opposite. She's very nice. She's easy to work with. Yeah, she's awesome. And so because of like, not only her, but just so many people that had then joined the team, like George, and a lot of our early scholars have now come back and are either tutors or they're like heavily involved. So Dina, George, Jingi, Jack, you know, they all came back and started helping out with various aspects of the work. And so because of that, we've been able to like really grow. And actually the other part is the Medics Academy team. The team are just like super brilliant. I mean, they just go, they take on a challenge, and despite like all the trouble of working with me, which is trouble generally, because like I've constantly got about 15 things going on at once, they just jump in and sort it all out and get things done, and they're like just really, really good. So we were able to scale it, which was, we were really fortunate to be able to do.
So what sort of things are you looking for in potential HLA scholars?
The whole point of the HLA is basically to try and support people in that early stage of their career and to help them become successful, right? So how do we support them to become as successful as they can be? And so what we try and do is effectively just support them to make their career, guide them through that early part of their leadership journey of their career. It is important for people, like when you're applying for the scholarship, because there's so many applicants and it is quite competitive, we're also very clear it's not really a beginner's leadership journey thing. It's not like we're looking for people that I want to get on the, like, learn about leadership. We run programs for people in that situation. So there are like some stuff that we've got for specifically designed for the beginner stuff, which is or people early on, which is around, we call it the intermediate leadership program. But the what we're actually trying to do with the HLA is look at more of the like someone who's already got some degree of leadership experience, whether that's as a student or whatever. And then how do we enhance it? How do we develop it? How do we give people that chance to take it to the next level? So to build on the experiences they've already had rather than just simply learning from scratch, as it were.
So is this program, you know, specifically made for medical students, or is it very much open to, you know, a range of healthcare professionals?
So we're agnostic about where people are in their careers. We've had we have cohorts from everything from medical students and nursing students all the way up to NHS consultants, all on the same cohort, at the same like group, right? We're agnostic about that, because often actually what's really interesting in the healthcare system is that, and we see this with the people that we get, is that people can be quite senior clinically, but they might not have very much genuine leadership experience, right? And like, the reality is with most of our programs, they're very practical. Like, we make people do things, like basically do projects and actually apply what we're talking about, and then reflect on that experience, right? So there's a lot of courses out there that are very theory-based. You go and you learn the theories of leadership, and you kind of, you know, you discuss it in small groups, etc. But basically, that's not what we do, right? We basically, we very much make people go through that journey of leadership and critique it and help them and get their cohorts to work together on things and build up networks for them and with them. And that seems to work extremely effectively. I mean, like, the feedback we get is consistently like extraordinarily high. And so what we want to try and do with that is so we're agnostic about what level they are. I mean, they could be medical students, they could be students or nursing students or whatever, but they also can be quite senior. And the main thing is just that they come into it, especially with the scholars program at the HLA. That's a really big deal. With the scholars program at the HLA, they've got to come in with the view that they definitely want to make a difference in the world, right? They have to want to change the world in a positive way. They've got to want to move, like make a difference in a health system. And as long as they've got that kind of that ambition and that drive, then it's fine. And one of the things I say to them always is that I don't shy away from ambitious people. I don't think ambition is a bad thing. I know it has, like, often people don't, especially in healthcare, don't like to talk about their ambition, but ambition is not a bad thing. It's how you execute that ambition that's so important. If you step on other people to succeed, or if you like you're doing something like that, that is a negative thing. Whereas if you're driven to make the world a better place, then that is important. You know, people like, very, very impressive people like Nelson Mandela and all that, they're clearly people that are ambitious for the greater good. You know, they're ambitious to make a change. They're not, and that's really, really important, I think, as a person who wants to take on a leadership role.
Well, Johan, it's been an absolute pleasure having the show today. But before we go, I'm just wondering whether you had, you know, three pieces of advice that you could give to students who are interested in possibly pursuing a leadership role in the future.
The first thing I'd say is make sure that you look at the people around you and work out who is, so not just the people that you might put on a pedestal, so not the people that might have a title or have like professor in front of their name or any of that stuff, right? But look at the people around you that you have access to. And remember that in 10 years' time or 15 years' time, those people are going to be, you know, they're going to be 15 years along. That if they're exciting and their trajectory in life is rapid, is like on a vertical, make sure you're around them, right? Because they are the people you want to, as they grow, you grow, and as you grow, you learn, right? And so I always advise people, like our scholars, you know, find the people in your life that you think inspire you and be near them, right? And I do that with my own team, right? There are lots of members of my team who genuinely inspire me, like, all the time, to drive me to be more successful. And I think that's important, to surround yourself with those people. The second thing I'd say is make sure that, and this may sound really ridiculous sometimes when you say it, but if you're in a leadership position, make sure you are the stupidest person in the room when you're in your team, right? Because if you are the stupidest person in the room, that means that some really smart people have decided to work with you, right? So people think that leadership is all about being the one who has all the answers, being the person that makes all the decisions, being the person that is like doing all the hard work. Leadership is all about being fortunate enough to work with teams that are genuinely impressive, right? And if you can be the stupidest person in the room, I always want to be the stupidest person in the room I'm in, because if I'm the stupidest person in the room I'm in, that means all the other people in that room are like choosing to be there because they have choices, they have options to take, right? And by doing that, I'm learning constantly off them. I'm learning about them. I'm learning about what drives success. I'm learning all these things, right? So, and you need to know in a leadership position, you need to not feel insecure in knowing that you are the stupidest person in the room, right? Because if you're insecure in that, then there's a problem. But if you're secure in who you are and you can look around you and just be so in awe of the people you get to work with and not be like threatened by that, then you will honestly flourish as a human being, as a person. So I think that's the second thing. The final thing is, I say to all of the scholars, right, the limitations on most people sit in their head. Right. So when you think that the world is against you, or you don't have choices or whatever, especially when you are in healthcare, if you are already a nurse or a medical student or a doctor or whatever, right, the limitations on your ability to succeed are not external often. They are sometimes, you know, there is institutional racism, sexism, all of those things. But a lot of the time, the limitations are in your head. You think you don't have the ability to do something. You think that somehow, you know, you don't have the right to do something. You know, the Nadine Abbas's whole kind of project on not just a medical student, like, highlighted that in stereo to me, right? Which was that often we have medical students that say, I am just the medical student, right? And I'm like, what are you talking about? At the age of 23, 24, 25, in the rest of the world, there are people who have started billion-dollar companies and who are now running, you know, running massive teams, or who are negotiating like deals with countries and stuff. How is you just being a medical student an acceptable statement to make? And it's not their problem. It's society that has made that, has pushed on them that idea, right? So I always say to the scholars that I work with, just make sure, you know, just realize the biggest barrier to your success is not external. It will be in your head and your imposter syndrome about succeeding. So if you strip that away and we start, you know, you start focusing on what you can achieve and the goals you can have, then you will succeed in life.
Hey guys, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the podcast. I hope you really enjoyed it. If you did, I'd really appreciate it if you give us a rating on Apple Podcasts. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, with all the links in the description below. Until next time, thank you so much for listening and take care.